tax policy, infrastructure spending, and cottage cheese on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 28th of November. Great to have you along, as it always is, everybody. We begin today with the number 53. 53 days until Inauguration Day. 53 days until this is officially Donald Trump's economy. Analysts and economists being who they are, though, they are already trying to figure out what that economy is going to look like. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said this morning that government spending and tax cuts, like the stuff President-elect Trump has been talking about, could bump American economic growth up to something like 3% in the next couple of years, and that if other countries follow suit and do the same thing, we could soon see global growth jump as well. But, and you knew there would be a but here, a lot of things have to go right for that to happen. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
There is one silver lining to the sluggish pace of economic growth in the U.S. and many of the world's advanced economies. Interest rates are pretty low.
It's a perfect time for governments to do a little borrowing or do a little tax cuts and get their economies going again.
Catherine Mann is chief economist of the OECD. In principle, this is straightforward Keynesian economics, but under President Trump, it's not so straightforward.
Devil is in the details here.
Robert Kahn is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Several things have to happen for a Trump tax cut and infrastructure stimulus to go right. First, it has to happen.
You really have to have agreement in Congress on a broad-based infrastructure plan.
Second, it won't work if Congress cancels it out somewhere else in the budget.
You have to assume that this agreement doesn't require large offsetting cuts. If it's offset, it's not going to be stimulative, and in fact would be contractionary in the near term.
Third, you have to hope inflation won't become a problem. William Klein is senior fellow at the Peterson Institute.
If you add a huge fiscal stimulus onto an economy that's close to full employment, you're going to get inflation.
Inflation, if high enough, would require the Fed to raise interest rates significantly, which would actually hurt economic growth. Lastly, for Donald Trump's infrastructure stimulus plan to spur the economy, you have to assume that he won't keep his other campaign promises on trade, like slapping 45% tariffs on Chinese imports.
If you have a downward spiral of escalating trade conflict, that's a recipe for recession.
The OECD's Catherine Mann calculated what a trade war would do to the economies of the U.S., Europe, and Japan.
It takes about 2 percentage points off of GDP.
More than erasing the bump from any stimulus. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
All right, so picking up on that theme then, taxes and cuts there too, we get now to the idea of tax reform, an idea gathering steam in pre-Trumpian Washington. For the first time in a very long while, Republicans are going to be in a position to pass sweeping tax reform for individuals and for companies in this economy. With reform comes change, though, and companies that have benefited from the way things are pushing back on the current corporate tax reform proposal from Republicans in the House. Lobbyists for big box retailers in particular aren't happy about a proposed new tax on imports, stuff like clothing and furniture and appliances that they buy cheap overseas and then sell less cheap over here. From the Marketplace Bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Let's take a made-up generic big-box retailer. Call it Targ Depot Mart. It imports tomatoes from Mexico, appliances from China, T-shirts from Bangladesh. Right now, it gets to deduct those costs before it pays its income tax bill. Under the Republican tax plan, it could no longer do that, says Caroline Freund at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
So if you import a shirt for $20 and sell it for $25, let's say you couldn't deduct any of the imported goods, then you'd be paying taxes on the full $25, which would raise your tax bill.
Except retailers aren't likely to just swallow any new import tax, says David French of the National Retail Federation, which opposes this part of the Republican plan.
Our assumption is retailers will have to pass the costs on, increase the price of goods.
And that's part of the point, to make imports more expensive and domestic products cheaper. Because anything made here, whether sold at Targ Depot Mart or exported overseas, wouldn't carry the import tax penalty. This could help U.S. manufacturers, or maybe not, says Eric Toder at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center.
this really basically doesn't matter because the value of the U.S. dollar will rise. Importers will pay more tax, but they'll pay less for imports.
Plus, Republicans say their proposal also includes a big across-the-board cut to corporate income tax rates, and that could help retailers offset their higher costs for imported tomatoes, appliances, and T-shirts. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I'm sure the timing was serendipitous, but today, for the first time in 50 years, a scheduled commercial flight flew from the U.S. to Havana, Cuba, just one of the changes under an Obama administration deal that lifted some U.S. sanctions on Cuba. President-elect Trump says he might undo that deal unless the Cuban government, after the death this past weekend of Fidel Castro, gives greater freedom to its people. That is a coming change of tone that has American businesses weighing their options. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on that.
President-elect Trump was pretty clear in his tweet this morning. If Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate the deal. A far cry from the diplomatic normalization of the Obama administration.
I think businesses are trying to read the tea leaves just like everyone else.
Ted Pacone is a fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution.
The bet is that the incoming administration will not mess with the travel-related rules.
The Obama administration loosened travel restrictions a couple of years ago, and the travel industry reacted. Tom Popper is president of Insight Cuba, which plans tours to the island. He said his business has more than doubled since December of 2014, and it's not alone.
The commercial airlines have more than doubled the daily departures to Havana itself. There's multiple cruise companies that are looking to receive authorization to bring their ships into the port of Havana.
Businesses like American Airlines, JetBlue, and Marriott have already invested in expanding in Cuba. So now?
I imagine they are very busy alerting their Washington-based lobbyists to try to contact the incoming Trump administration.
Richard Feinberg is author of Open for Business, Building the New Cuban Economy. He says Trump's comments on Cuba don't close the door to normal diplomatic relations.
Now, U.S. policy can accelerate that or slow it down. And that remains to be seen what approach the Trump administration takes.
He says an opening of the Cuban economy is inevitable. Just look at China and Vietnam. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Selling into the close is the phrase you're looking for vis-a-vis Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is not your typical presidential transition, so stipulated. But set aside for a minute the president-elect's Twitter feed and the unorthodox nature of the process so far, especially for the very top-level jobs in the cabinet, and think for a minute about the Republican policy professionals who would typically staff up an incoming GOP administration. We're talking about people's livelihoods here, people who've waited 8 years for this chance and who are now wondering whether it'd be better to work inside the administration or outside it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
Washington is like a big merry-go-round. When your party is in power, you reach for the brass ring, a job in the White House, or your favorite government agency. When your party's on the outs, you take refuge in a think tank or lobby shop. But Donald Trump has never had anything to do with that merry-go-round. He's more like a train that is smashed right into the merry-go-round. People who would normally be applying for White House jobs are wondering, do I want to work for Trump in light of the things he said? For example, his lewd comments about women.
Did I like hearing them? No.
This is Anne E.W. Stone. She volunteered for Trump in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, says she's met with him and worked with him, and plans to apply for a job in the Trump administration because
it's important for the country, again, that he has strong women's voices around him and a women's perspective on a lot of his policy development.
Another Trump supporter has reached a similar conclusion. Giano Caldwell is an African-American GOP strategist in Washington. He also wants to work from within.
If you're not in the game, then you're not thought about. So he's the only game in town. I mean, you can protest or you can be a part of the process.
Caldwell wants to change things from within, but that can be difficult for a number of reasons, according to David Luban, a law professor at Georgetown University. On a practical level, he says,
look, you can't be a dissenter all the time and keep the job.
Luban says a number of people who've been offered jobs in the incoming Trump administration have asked his advice, wondering if they fundamentally disagree with Trump on major issues, should they work for him?
What I said was, if you think that this administration is making promises that to do things that you really abhor, then you just can't go in.
But Luban says people who do decide to go in may be influenced by those around them. They forget about the stuff they originally objected to, the stuff they were going to change.
You may think that you want to stay on board because you can work for the lesser evil, but you may think that you can tame the beast, but the beast is going to tame you.
Even with warnings like that, you got to believe people are thinking, hey, wouldn't it be cool to have White House on your resume?
I would relish the opportunity to work in an administration of any kind.
This is 19-year-old Henry Bendon. He's an eager political science major at Case Western Reserve University. I caught him in a stairwell between classes. Bendon supported Hillary Clinton, even volunteered for her. Then after the election, he and a friend went on the Trump transition site to look for jobs, first as a joke, but then they thought, hey, maybe we can help unify the country if we apply, and we'd get some valuable experience.
Honestly, any chance I could have to work with people or near people and on any capacity, I would be thrilled about.
So the Washington merry-go-round keeps on turning. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Two thoughts by way of setting up this next story. Thought number one, all the talk of President Trump wanting as much as $1 trillion to be spent on infrastructure in his administration. Thought number two, the promised wall that is coming along the Mexican border. Those are so far, anyway, not much more than promises from the incoming White House. But at ports of entry along the border, how much the federal government spends on facilitating trade and travel is a very real concern. Such a concern, in fact, that private companies and local governments are paying for improvements and upgrades themselves to move things along. From the Fronteras desk at KJZZ, Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
Come in, Chuy, come in.
At Omega Trucking in Santa Teresa, New Mexico, an employee checks in on a driver moving a load across the border. This is a family-run business that transports things like tiles and construction materials for bigger companies. The owner, Miriam Kutkowski, says private investment at the ports helps everybody.
If we don't have an efficient port, we don't have trade. And if the private sector is allowed to help, that is wonderful. This is a greater benefit for the industrial base.
Her trucks routinely drive through this border crossing in Santa Teresa. Trucks used to hit a bumpy dirt road soon after crossing into Mexico. That was 25 years ago when Jerry Pacheco, a local businessman, stood out in a dust storm and envisioned the barren desert transformed into a bustling industrial hub. Today, his vision has started to take shape.
Our commercial traffic grew 26% last year, which is one of the highest, if not the highest, rates on the entire U.S.-Mexico border.
Pacheco is president of a local industrial association tasked with recruiting businesses to this area. His job got a bit easier once the road through Mexico was paved. But the biggest development came in 2009, when the Taiwanese manufacturer Foxconn set up a massive factory just south of the border fence. That plant now churns out 55,000 Dell computers a day and sends them north.
Foxconn is a huge win for us because of all the truck traffic and development it's brought to the port of entry.
But now, Pacheco says, federal investment in the port is lagging behind commercial investment around the port. Most of the money Congress allocates for the border goes toward security, not infrastructure.
If we don't continue to focus on the port, we're not going to be competitive in the future.
As a result, the private sector has stepped in. This year, Dell, the computer maker, will pay at least $200,000 to staff a southbound cargo lane 4 extra hours a day. The longer the border crossing stays open, the better for business. This is possible thanks to a special program that started in 2013. Chris Sullivan with U.S. Customs explains.
If a private entity is trying to perhaps increase business at an airport or get more commercial cargo through a port of entry, they can reimburse the government for our services.
Services like overtime pay for customs officers or infrastructure like a new cargo lane or inspection facility. Local and state governments also pitch in. For example, the city of El Paso is using toll money to keep all lanes staffed on weekdays at a couple of its border crossings. Beto O'Rourke is the U.S. congressman who represents El Paso.
It means that people are waiting fewer minutes in line or able to get to class or to see a loved one or to buy their groceries or to go to work much more quickly and conveniently.
But O'Rourke says it's not enough. Last fiscal year, it cost El Paso more than $1 million to shorten commercial wait times by about 20 minutes. Even with that reduction, total wait times can range anywhere from 1 to 5 hours. In Santa Teresa, New Mexico, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People are eager to find a new star in that aisle, and they're hopeful that cottage cheese might do that.
Yep, cottage cheese. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 54 points on this Monday, 0.25%, 19,097 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 30 points, 0.5%, 5368. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points, again about 0.5%, 2201. Their Best Buy trimmed 2.75% today. Target down 1.1%. Amazon told investors it's had strong sales, but it sheared off 1.75% all the same today. Biggest retail winners over the weekend? Anybody whose store works well on a phone. Boy, I'll tell you what, purchases by mobile devices topped $1 billion for the first time on Friday. Apple's stock trimmed 0.2% today, though. Samsung Electronics closed up about 1.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker.
If we want to survive, we need to change our bodies.
I never in my wildest dreams when I was teaching her how to do this thought that she would actually have to do it.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a vote in the European Parliament last week that is going to turn into a geopolitical headache for European leaders. EU lawmakers voted to suspend Turkey's bid for membership in the European Union in the wake of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's crackdown on dissent after the failed coup there last July. After the vote, Erdogan said he may now pull out of the deal he made with the EU that has stopped tens of thousands of migrants from reaching Europe proper. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more on the story.
Since the coup, tens of thousands of Turks have been imprisoned, 100,000 civil servants suspended or fired. Asli Aydin Tashbash is with the European Council on Foreign Relations in Istanbul.
Turkey is moving away from Europe and basically becoming more and more of a Middle Eastern country, I think, in this context.
The European Parliament's vote to freeze Turkey's membership talks is only advisory. It's up to the EU heads of government to put it into effect. They won't, says Rem Korteweg of the Centre for European Reform. They don't want to jeopardise the deal they've struck with Turkey to stem the flow of migrants into Europe.
Despite all the odds, it has worked. It has brought down the very large numbers of irregular migrants making their way across the Aegean Sea towards Greece.
And, says Asli Aydin Tashbash, Europe's leaders don't want to alienate a pillar of the NATO alliance.
They do not want to push Turkey too far out, basically into the bosom of Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has mused about turning his back on the EU and joining instead the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, led by Russia and China. But Robert O'Daly of the Economist Intelligence Unit thinks that's unlikely.
Turkey's economic trade and investment ties with the EU are far greater than those with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries.
Indeed, says Rem Korteweg, two-thirds of foreign investment in Turkey comes from the EU, with another large chunk from the US.
And that money might find other locations if Turkey is seen to backslide or drift away from its Western orientation.
Erdogan has threatened to hold a referendum on whether Turkey should now even bother seeking EU membership. Given the abysmal relations between the two, a resounding no seems probable. But, says Korteweg, the referendum might only be advisory, just like that vote in the European Parliament. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I have very few preconditions for the interviews I do on this program. Within reason, I'll talk to almost anybody about almost anything. For the interview you're about to hear, though, I did draw a line. I said I would do it only if I got to say blech on the air. The immediate object of my blechdom is cottage cheese, the subject of a story in the Wall Street Journal the other day, headlined, "Could Cottage Cheese Ever Be Cool?" I think you know where I stand. Ellen Byron had the byline on the piece. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
So I know that reporters don't get to choose their own headlines, but could cottage cheese ever be cool? The answer has to be no, right?
Well, you'd think so. And yeah. Yes, that headline did get some jokes from our readers who said, just put it in the refrigerator.
Right. Get it? Refrigerator? Cool. Get it? Come on. But here's the deal. Cottage cheese comes with some baggage.
It does. It was this 1970s diet food that has a reputation it's desperately trying to shed. It's often thought of as being lumpy, watery, old-fashioned, and usually inconvenient.
Yeah. All of which are true, right? I mean, if you think about it, first of all, it goes on like a pineapple slice, and it just doesn't look all that appetizing. Who had the idea to bring back cottage cheese?
Well, there's a number of players, actually, who really want a cottage cheese revival. There are some entrenched players who have been around for generations who are trying to shake up their packaging, add some exciting flavors. And then there's newcomers, upstarts, who are trying to really eke out some advantage in the dairy aisle by saying, look, this food is so high in protein, it's low in sugar, let's shake it up and remind people that cottage cheese is good.
Cottage cheese is envious of Greek yogurt, basically, is what you're saying, right? Because Greek yogurt came on and everybody was like, oh, this is the greatest thing. And cottage cheese is sitting there going, wait, what about me?
Yes, Greek yogurt is truly known as a darling of the dairy aisle because it came onto the scene and some years ago and just proclaimed its high protein content. Yeah. But now as that category is maturing, people are eager to find a new star in that aisle, and they're hopeful that cottage cheese might do that.
This is not a small market, we should say. I mean, they've got a small share of dairy cottage cheese does, but they do like $1 billion a year.
That surprised me, actually, because sometimes it's even hard to spot cottage cheese in the refrigerated cases because it is so small. But yeah, it still pulls in $1 billion a year. And that is what has a lot of people in the cottage cheese business excited. There are people already buying cottage cheese. Let's get them to buy more of it. And then let's try to grab some eyeballs from the yogurt section.
And they're doing it with single-serving portions. And also, you got to admit, some gimmicky flavors, right? That, like, there's Kalamata olive flavor and basil parmesan and all kinds
roasted
of stuff.
Roasted red pepper, yeah, no. Even maple and vanilla. Yes, they're all over the place. And, again, that is definitely trying to draw your eyeballs to these cottage cheese packages.
Which do you prefer, large or small curd?
I think I'm a small curd kind of person.
All right. Well, so here's I mean, there's actually a substance behind that question, which is one of the experts you talked to in this piece talked about how, and I can't actually believe I'm saying this, cottage cheese is harder work because you have to chew more?
Yeah. And so this brand manager at Organic Valley, he was saying, look, it can be more satisfying because you do have to chew more than with a creamy yogurt. You'll like it better.
Last time I had cottage cheese, I don't think I chewed. You just kind of
snork it down, right?
Well, this is one of the really fun parts of covering the food industry, to be honest, is that there really are experts in this industry who concentrate on your jaw motion as you eat different food. Wow. And wonder if one might make you buy more than another.
Ellen Byron is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal in New York. Ellen, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
This final note on the way out today, it is Cyber Monday, as you have surely heard, the latest in a long string of manufactured excuses to get us to go shopping. Manufactured though it may be, the occasion is not lost on the Trump for President campaign store. 25% off you can get using the promo code GREATDEAL. Sadly for you, the Black Friday discount was 30%.
All right, we got to go. The Dow off 54 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 30 points, about 0.5% there. The S&P 500, 11 points to the downside again, about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.